Good morning. We are fastly, that's not a word, right? I've used that before. We are quickly approaching a new year, and we will see what 21 has in store for us. This morning we're chugging along. Chase Wagler, if you are watching from Florida, we are getting along without you. Barely getting along without you. We are coming, rounding the corner very quickly on this look at Genesis in the beginning. And so we've got probably three or four more weeks that we will be finishing up that, and we're going to head into a very short, probably three, maybe four-week look of this series called Baggage, of looking at heading into 21 and what we may be carrying along with us and may not even know it, and then looking on to do a study in the book of Ephesians. And so we're excited about kind of what God has, and He's directing us and showing us as we head into 21, out from the beginning of Genesis and moving on in His Word. And this morning, we're in Genesis 32. So if you have a phone or tablet or the real deal, paper, we'll be in Genesis 32. And really, this big picture is this idea that God shows up in unexpected ways. We saw that Christmas, right? We realize we come to this point where the Redeemer, where the King came in a form of these swaddling clothes, in the form of an infant, defenseless infant. So God shows up in unexpected ways, and more importantly, we're going to see that when I am at a breaking point, you can trust God will be there for you. There's usually a but, right? But He might not do what you expect Him to do. And so we know for a fact when we find ourselves at this breaking point, you can trust that God will be there, but it may not necessarily be the way we expect it. So we're in Genesis 32, and I feel like we could probably rewind and just kind of some highlights on Jacob specifically before we get into this, that we've already plowed that ground, but just kind of keep fresh in our mind. Jacob wasn't one of the nicest people to be featured in the Bible. I mean, let's just, you know, call it what it is. It is what it is. I mean, his name meant cheater, right? He was born a second behind his twin brother Esau, and he wasn't real happy about that. One day, his brother Esau comes in working in the field. He's ravenous. He smells this soup, and he wants some more than maybe he's ever wanted soup in his life. I don't know. And okay, says Jacob, you can have some on one condition. And Jacob demands in exchange for the soup that he give him his birthright, and we saw that in Genesis 25. And the discord in the home progresses, and after stealing his brother's blessing, Jacob is forced to leave home, and he goes to his uncle Laban's home, where he falls in love with Laban's daughter Rachel. And then after many, many years of living there, eventually marries both of Laban's daughter. Jacob reaches this point where conflict at his second home forces him to leave. And while on the road, which is where we're picking up, on the road he learns that his brother, whose birthright and blessing that he stole, is headed toward him with 400 men. Yeah. And so Genesis 32, 1 through 8, Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." So he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, and in the land of Seir, in the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus he shall say to my lord," "my lord, Esau, his brother, thus say to your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen, donkey, flocks, male servants, female servants. I have sent to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight." I'm sensing a little bit of insecurity and fear here. And the messengers returned to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau." They don't bother telling him what he said. They just said, maybe he didn't say anything. "He is coming to meet you. And there are 400 men with him." And then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him and the flocks and herds and camels into two camps, kind of kicking into self-preservation mode here, thinking if Esau comes to one camp and attacks it, we've got the other camp is left and we'll escape. But then here we see Jacob do something totally out of character. And for the first time that we see that we have recorded in Scripture anyway, we see Jacob pray. And he prays in Genesis 32, 9 through 12. Jacob says, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred, I may do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all these deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hands of my brother and from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, 'I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.'" And after praying, Jacob goes back and goes back to his skillful manipulation. He divides the camp. He's got this game plan. Again, that way, if Esau hurts one group, maybe the other group will remain. And he continues, he devises this plan where he sends groups of animals, of these gifts, off in sections to go and meet Esau in hopes of gaining favor. He sends off the group across this fjord, and he finds himself there the night that we see in Scripture. And in verse 22 through 32, we see this really unexpected situation play out. God shows up in very unexpected ways. And this is where we're going to kind of camp out for the remainder of our morning. In Genesis 32, 22 through 32, we read, "The same night he rose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and their 11 children, and crossed the ford of Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else he had, and Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. And then he said, 'Let me go, for the day has broken.' But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And then he said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Then Jacob asked him, please tell me your name. But he says, why is it you ask for my name? And there he blessed him. So Jacob called that place, the name of that place, Peniel, saying, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. The sun rose upon him as he passed, limping because of his hip. And therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip. And so Jacob gets attacked, we see in Scripture, by a man, and then wrestles all night long. But as we continue to read, this man seems to be more than just a mere mortal. In verse 30, he appears to be God himself. This odd story of Jacob standing by the creek and then being attacked by an angel is actually Jacob wrestling with God. And certainly Jacob didn't see the wrestling for what it was, kind of this parable of his entire life. Because throughout the long narrative, we see Jacob's life has been characterized as a grasping struggle, right? Jacob had wrestled with his brother, and then with his father, and then with his father-in-law, and now with God. Jacob has always struggled to this point with man and with God. And during this time, we see several things happen when Jacob wrestles with God. First, God breaks Jacob. That does not sound very pleasant. Jacob's standing by a body of water, and he's on the edge of the promised land. He's all alone, and he gets attacked out of nowhere by this mystery man, and they wrestle all night. But clearly, again, the attacker is holding back. Because it's only when he sees the sun about to come up that he just touches Jacob's hip socket and cripples him. Now, this has to be a highly emotional time for Jacob. He knows what he's come out of. He knows what's standing in front of him, his brother and a garrison of soldiers coming with him. He's worried about what will happen. And God answers that prayer by physically attacking Jacob and bringing him to his knees. Odd response? Maybe. But often the same sort of things happen in our lives. When we are at our breaking point, God will be there. When we are at our breaking point, God will be there. But again, he may not show up in the way we expect or do the things we expect him to do. See, before he makes it better, he makes it worse for Jacob. In this moment, he weakens him. He literally brings him to his knees. There's a writer, Henry Nguyen, that writes about how God treats us much like the communion bread. And we see this here, that he chooses us, he blesses us, he breaks us, and then he sends us. You see that here. God chooses Jacob. He blesses Jacob, and now he's breaking Jacob. And there is a point. There is a point for this brings Jacob to a moment of honest confession. Jacob confesses his identity. We read in Genesis 32:27, and he said to him, "What is your name?" And he says, "Jacob." Now, names back then were a lot more than just what parents liked. Now we come again across a unique name, or we go back and many times find kind of the reason or the meaning behind it. But then it was all about meaning. It was all about history and meaning and purpose, and many times even define the character of the person. And Jacob tells him, he says, "What's your name?" Jacob, which is cheater or trickster. "I'm Jacob. I'm the one who took advantage of my brother. I'm the one that cheated my father. I'm the one that tricked Laban. It's Jacob." And often when we are truly broken, when you feel as though you can be brought no lower, it's in that moment that you might as well be honest, right? You've got that. And this is probably about as low as Jacob can be. He narrowly escaped Laban. Esau, again, is ahead of him with hundreds of soldiers, and is suddenly attacked by this mystery person when he's all alone. Who is he? The trickster. It's all he's ever been, it's all he'll ever be, right? But we see in Scripture this mysterious stranger gives him a new name. "Your name shall no longer be Jacob. From now on, you will be called Israel, because you have fought with God and with man and have won." Jacob is given a new name, and with that, a new identity. Israel strives with God. Suddenly, this man pursuing his own happiness for so many years is the father of God's chosen people. His 12 sons suddenly take on new significance as the 12 tribes of Israel. The nation God promised to Abraham suddenly takes on flesh in the person of Jacob, who is now Israel. The life of Jacob up to this moment was a life not very different from every single one of us, really. He's living something like the American dream, right? When opportunity comes knocking, he doesn't hesitate to open the door. Desperate situation? Sure, I'll help. Just give me your birthright. To be blessed by my father? Sure, I'll lie to get that. You're giving me the wrong woman? Sure, I'll just make sure you still give me Rachel, too. And to this point, it's kind of worked. He's got it made, except he doesn't. I mean, we see that bigger picture. And when he came to the point of realizing that everything that he has, his world, is in danger, God shows up and makes it worse before making it better. He blesses Jacob with this new name, a one, again, with depth and meaning and purpose. Have you, like Jacob, encountered the living God? Have you encountered him in a way that completely broke you of your pride, of our selfishness, that shattered our expectations of what following him looks like? Did it bring you to this place of submission? Those are not words we like to hear. Breaking, submission. I've shared a couple of different times you know, kind of my ministry life being in construction years and years ago, and feeling this calling into ministry, which started down in Evansville at a little inner city church / missions, or missions that became a church, called the Potter's Wheel. And so, just by nature, I'm a fixer, a doer, a seeing something, immediately try and figure out what the problem may be or what a potential solution could be, and then executing that. Not saying it's always the best plan, but seeing it and going with it. So my ministry started very much like that, very much active, pioneering, seeing something, figuring something out, putting a formula to it, and going. And we very quickly found ourselves literally waist deep in kids throughout a neighborhood on the southeast side of Evansville. Just wanting to be around somebody that wants to be around them. And so one thing led to another, and we remodeled area, you know, in the basement of that little place, and it was going. Not because of what I was doing or we were doing as a team, but just God drew kids there. But again, it was, okay, now what can we do? Now what can we do with this? Now what can we do with that? That led then to feeling very comfortable and confident that God was calling us to this little Mayberry called Washington, Indiana. And was blessed with the opportunity to work in student ministries just right out on the highway there at Antioch. And so landed feet down. What do we do? What do we got? Let's assess the situation and let's go. Which then led to a lot of relationships and friendships that I still have, many of which I still have today. It was met with building a new facility for students and piggybacking on ideas that other people already had, and doing this thing called the Hub on a Friday night during basketball season that sometimes saw as many as 200 to 300 junior high kids in a gym, which is not where you want to be on a Friday night with 200 to 300 junior high and high school kids, unless you're playing dodgeball. That is always a part of the formula. There was opportunity, was blessed with being a part of Powerhouse as Dean Loniger, just his amazing tenure in that place, kind of stepped in and was able to fill some gaps there. But again, it came to, what do we got? What do we need? Let's do this. Then I transitioned into more of a leadership capacity at ACC, and I very quickly found myself, probably 5 or 6 years ago, absolutely, completely, utterly burned up and burned out. I tried to find, I was going to read for the first time. I always, if I'm in one of those situations, if I can do better, try and grabbing something on paper than I can talking about it. And I remember punching something out to share with the elders, the leadership there that night. And I was going to actually try and read that. And it's probably on another hard drive somewhere else. But I remember one specific part during that I wrote and came. And it says, I've hit a wall. And I have absolutely no energy and no desire to go over it, to go under it, to go around it. I'm done. That leadership in there wisdom and generosity sent me to a place for a couple of weeks to kind of unpack and get some direction. I went to a place called Blessing Ranch, which at one time was out in Colorado, is now still going ministry, but it's located down in Florida. And I didn't really receive some big revelation or life-altering, like, vision, but I started to understand some things. And it was shortly after coming back from that point, with some great insight from different people, came to the ministry here at Harvest. And that's been almost 6 years ago now at this point. And as I'm here, God is continuing to show me and realize more and more that it's not about any one person. It's not about assessing the situation and then us coming up with our human strategy. But I sit back, hindsight's always 20/20, right? I sit back and I see over the past 5 to 6 years how God has been faithful in his promise and continues to build just a team here in this place. And it's not about the person that's sitting up here. It's not about whoever's in front on the microphone. It's kind of about our whoever's helping run the video stuff, Chase. But I was done. Much like when God touched Jacob's hip. Oh, and if that wasn't enough, God keeps me relying on him instead of relying on myself through this season of raising these littles. Because this weekend, unbelievable time. But the last couple of nights have just been, I need them in bed. Hopefully, they don't go online so they can't hear. They're four, I don't know. I need them in bed, and I need everybody else to go away so that I can just sit on this couch. Like, I can't do this. And I go, and then I realize, yeah, I can't do this. It's only by the grace of God that I have this woman to do life with and these kids that are a true blessing. But, oh my word, it's intense. Everybody that's got kids that age, it's intense. I'm not in any unique situation. Jacob was bound and determined to get that blessing from God. He didn't let go. He didn't run away. When he was in what appeared to be the hardest challenge of his life, he clung to God. And this strange encounter at the river turns into this blessing of the world. Right? This account of Jacob's struggle with God, it's not some fanciful tale. This struggle did not occur in a dream or a vision. I mean, it was real. He literally limped after that point. The struggle changed him, not only outwardly in his walk, but inwardly in his heart. And that work in Jacob's life that God had started 20 years before at Bethel, we saw in Genesis 28, was now coming to a climax. Jacob had come to know God at Bethel, but he now knew him face to face. So what's the difference? Well, when Jacob started wrestling with the angel, he was resisting, right? He was fighting, he was defending himself. And then when he became disabled and began to recognize that he was wrestling with God himself, he stopped struggling and just held on. Rewind that. He was struggling, he was fighting, and when he came to this realization that he was wrestling with God, he stopped struggling and held on. It was then that God overcame Jacob's resistance, his self-will, and Jacob, in turn, was able to obtain this blessing, this true blessing, and know God face to face. If we, too, hope to know God in this way, we can't approach him on our own terms. We have to allow him to disable us, to break us. We can't develop this intimate relationship with God without being broken, without first allowing our self-will, our self-centeredness to be made lame by God. Only then will we be able to gain God's deepest blessings and to know him in this face-to-face relationship. So, we've seen this theme throughout from the very first verses in Scripture, and we see it play through the entire Bible. Jacob's life is this story of relentless grace. Grace. This tenacious grace in that it would not let him go. This contending grace that it was always battling for his soul. This intrusive grace, really, because it wouldn't be shut out. This renovating grace because it gave him this new limp and a new name. It's about grace. This is the God who has redeemed us. He wrestled Satan on the cross and won. He's given us new life, and now that we are his, he will not let us go. But we've got to submit. We've got to stop struggling. We've got to come to him on his terms. How blessed we are when we yield to God at the beginning of God's call, much like Abraham and Joseph, but so many of us are like Jacob. We struggle independently of the God who we believe and love. We want to be a part of his plan, but instead we make our own plans. We never really truly succeed. Then a crisis comes through. He lays his hand upon us. Life becomes dislocated or out of joint. We have this appalling sense of our own incompetence and weakness. And that is the hour of grace. It's nothing that we have done. This is one of my favorite verses that comes out of Ephesians, and so I'm excited to kind of get through as we go into looking at the baggage that we walk around with in a series, and then head into the book of Ephesians. We'll have time to elaborate on that. But that is the hour of grace. Because from there, our walk is never the same, right? God may be wrestling with some of us today. He may be saying, to us, no, regardless of how clever or astute or capable that we are, you have believed in me, but you have always manipulated, right? You've always been looking at the angle. You've always made your own arrangements, and he's asking us, much like Jacob, child, what's your name? What's your name? So this morning, I'm not asking, but God's asking, what's your name? Where are you at? Who are you? Because I want to walk with you, and regardless of the past, of where you found yourself in this place, I want to give you a new name. I want to give you a new heart. I want you to walk with you in what you're living out. And so we have a time this morning to reflect on that, to take communion together. And I just thought it was really interesting when I came across that thought process where I was trying to come back and find it. How God chooses us, he finds us, he chooses us, he breaks us, and then he sends us out. And it's that symbol of communion, this bread, this body that was broken, this juice, this the symbol of this blood that has been shed on our behalf, this relentless grace. So as we celebrate and continue to reflect on the birth of this little defenseless child that will one day rule this world, this universe, I just continue to ask you, who's your name, and invite you to come and take these emblems and reflect on his word that we've had this morning. Come, and we have several stations around the room. We have the juice and the bread together, so you can grab just one. But I would encourage you to come in this time and partake in communion with us.